Welcome to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas. Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello and welcome once again to Open Minds Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas. It's the most wonderful time of the year. I warned Jason that I was going to sing, and luckily he didn't mute me. He had threatened to, but these guys get to hear me sing all the time, and now you see why it's such a privilege for them to hear me singing all the time. But yes, this is our last show until Christmas, and in fact, we're going to take the 27th off. Also, so we're not going to have a show. We're just going to Christmas. We're going to Christmas so hard that we're not going to be able to do the show next week. We're going to have that much fun for Christmas, and I hope you do too. But today's guest, some of you might have seen that we were going to have Jim Mars on. But unfortunately, because of Christmas, you know how scheduling goes, some family stuff came up. But we have an excellent guest. Still, we have Michael Schratt. Aerospace historian, UFO researcher extraordinaire. You've probably seen some of his stories on the website and in the magazine. And essentially, you know, Michael has lectured across the country on the subject of mystery aircraft and classified propulsion systems buried deep within the military-industrial complex. And like we were just talking about, possibly deep within the ground and underground secret bases, some of which he has researched, and we'll talk some about that. But he's also illustrated a lot of UFO case files that he's investigated from case files of the Center for UFO Studies and other organizations. And that's what we've been posting on the internet that you've probably seen, which is really cool to be able to see, you know, what these UFOs look like that these people were seeing along with the witness testimony. So really cool. We got a lot to talk about because now we've been working together for a year. We've got a magazine out for a year now. The sixth issue will be coming out actually in February, just before the Congress. But the fifth one is out there. And hopefully you all who are subscribers and not have it. If you don't have it, as soon as the show is over, you're going to be able to run to the store and go pick it up at your Barnes & Noble or your Borders, because hopefully they're open with Christmas hours. If not, stop at the bookstore, get yourself a eggnog latte, and pick up the issue of the magazine. It'll help us out, and it'll help you out, because then you'll be in the know. Some great articles in this last magazine. Always great articles. A lot of fun. Also, we've got YouTubes going up all the time, lots of fun YouTubes. Last week's radio show has not been up on YouTube because Jason, who puts them up, was on a cruise in the Caribbean having a good old time swimming with some stingrays, the big manta rays. Are they manta rays or stingrays? We'll have to ask Jason. But visiting ancient Mayan ruins and discovering all the secrets about 2012. Actually, he would have, but he was distracted with drinking margaritas, I think, and climbing and then falling down the pyramids out there, the Mayan pyramids. No, we'll maybe see if he'll share a little bit about his cruise when he gets on the news here in a minute. A couple of things to tell you about. Of course, the Congress, I want to let you know, the rooms are really going fast. So if you are planning to come to the UFO Congress and you want to stay in the hotel that is absolutely beautiful and is half price that the Congress is being hosted in, the Radisson Fort McDowell, book your rooms now because they are going really quick. I understand a lot of you are waiting till after the holidays, you know, because you have some budget freed up. Maybe you're waiting for your tax money. But, you know, go take a present back. You've got time. And then book your hotel room instead. And tell little Johnny, you know, that his present's just going to be a little late. That Santa Claus got cut up in this horrible weather and he's running a little late. And then get him the present in a couple weeks. No, just kidding. But actually, as soon as you can after the holidays, get your rooms because they are going quick. And don't worry if you can't do that. You know, if you do have to wait till your tax money comes in or something, there are hotels very nearby that are also that are free shuttle will take you there. So no worries. Give us a call if you have any problems and you need some help. You can find our number on the website. But that is coming up. Get your room as soon as possible, and it's going to be terribly exciting. We have just, of course, a wonderful list of people, and I'm really excited. I mean, these names, Linda Howe, Leslie Keene, Paul Hellyer, ex-Minister of Defense. He's been on the show. All these guys have been on the show. Colonel Halt from the Rendlesham Forest, James Peniston, John Burroughs from the Jim Mars, you know, Stan Friedman, the old favorite, Richard Dolan. I mean, just incredible. And I left out a host of other cool people. We'll talk to Michael about what he's going to talk about at the Congress, too, here in a minute. The film festival also is going to be a lot of fun. We're getting a lot of great films. You still have about a week or so to get your film in if you're submitting one. We're asking everybody to get those in by January 1st. Give us a call if you're running late or anything. But this is going to be real exciting because this gives people the chance to win the coveted EBE Award. So if you've made a UFO-related film and you think it's pretty dang good, you know, submit it and we'll have the judges look at it. And just for clarification again, to let people know how this works, is what we're going to do is we're going to be judging on Tuesday, the 22nd of February. That's the day before the conference. If you're really into all the films, you want to see them all, come in that day. We're going to start them at 10 a.m. in the conference area. You'll see signs. It's free. Just come join us. Watch all the films all day, and you'll get to see them all. However, don't worry. If you can't do that, if you're coming in on Wednesday morning or something, then we're still going to show the top three films in each category in the evenings every night. You know, of course, what, two movies a night? We're not going to show them all every night, but we'll show them in the evening so you can still catch those movies. So it's going to be a lot of fun and a lot of good films. So it's really exciting, some cool stuff at the film festival. All of this, you can find out more at UFOCongress.com or, of course, OpenMinds.tv. OpenMinds.tv, you're going to find something else besides news about the Congress. You're going to find tons of other news there. Late-breaking UFO news, because we keep up on everything going on because we are your UFO news authority. And we even have a dedicated UFO news correspondent who fills us in every week here on the radio show. His name is Jason McClellan. Jason, are you there?
I am, Alejandro. Hello and greetings, everyone. This is your Open Minds News Brief for Monday, December 20th, 2010. This is a follow-up to a story we did last week. This is a great story. The mysterious objects that were seen and captured on video by several witnesses in Santa Monica earlier this month may have been identified. A spokesperson from Red Bull says that a team of Red Bull Air Force skydivers were in the air with powerful flares at the same time the witnesses captured mysterious fireballs in the sky above Santa Monica. That's interesting, but I don't know if you heard this, Alejandro, but both sightings, they were 2 days, December 1st and December 8th, exactly a week apart, that people captured this stuff on video. Several people captured video, different vantage points. And Red Bull has said that on both nights, they did have people in the air.
Oh, both nights. I heard that the first night
It was just December 1st, mm-hmm. But on their site, on the site for the Red Bull Air Force, they do say that on both of those nights, mm-hmm. they did have people in the sky.
Well, I wanted to note, too, you know, the NBC thing. I know a lot of people watch that where you were a part of the story because they interviewed you about that in NBC LA. But it did look like, you know, there was one guy who replied to our YouTube video of the NBC News report, and he was adamant that it was the flare parachuter guys. And I did see his point that it looked similar, but it was light enough where I thought, you know, you would have been able to maybe see these parachutes, but the movement was similar. And now it seems confirmed that that's what it was. And so that was kind of
well, I was skeptical
cool
at
him.
First because I saw the on the Red Bull Air Force website, they have actual video of this supposed dive they did of two guys jumping out of a plane. And they said they had flares, and that's how they explained the trail behind them. But I didn't see any flares on their feet at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I said feet.
That's cute.
On their feet. They did have a light on their helmet. But in the lighting of the... It seemed very dark when they did the dive. But in the video provided to us by a resident in Santa Monica, it was much lighter. But I think it's because the difference of the days. They didn't post a date on the video of the jump. But it's hard to tell. And I like to point out that this certainly shows how silly Bill Nye the Science Guy was to go on that NBC news report and claim that the people, the many people who filmed these things in the sky had faked the videos and superimposed sea monkeys. So it looked like something was in the sky. He claimed they were sea monkeys.
Yeah, that was one of was a shocker. Never heard that before, and surprise, surprise. Now, I thought it might turn out to be this parachute theory.
Right, and there were people early on who were speculating them.
Yeah, but I didn't for one second believe that those things were sea monkeys. That was ridiculous.
I think he was on his own with that assumption.
Well, it's rude. It's not looking at the facts, and it's silly. I can't believe... You know, and the press continue to go to people like him and Magaha who offer up these just ridiculous explanations.
There were dozens of videos from dozens of witnesses who all saw the same thing, had videos of the same thing. And these people were just random people. They didn't have any connection to each other. They all obviously didn't fake a video.
Yeah.
Kind of strange, but way to go, Bill Nye.
Well, and we should say, too, I want to say, I think I said something last time, I can't remember, to Jeremy Corbell, the main witness, good job for him. He really followed up. He really put all the pieces together and found all these other witnesses and witness videos, and he's really kept on top of this whole thing, and he's done a really extraordinary job as a witness to follow the story and what was
He really
going
has.
On.
Jeremy did an awesome job. In other news, several mass UFO sightings have occurred recently in Chile. One of these mass sightings took place a couple of weeks ago when a luminous object was observed by many residents of Santiago, Chile. Witnesses posted their sightings on Twitter, the popular online social communication tool. This prompted curious residents to emerge from their homes in hopes of seeing the strange object for themselves. The event reportedly caused the term UFO to become a hot trending topic on Twitter. And this is interesting, Alejandro, because it's happening more and more lately with this social media and how we hear about UFOs. It's much easier for every person who has a computer to report a UFO, not an official reporting to any sort of agency, but they can post online that I see a UFO outside my door.
That's what we need to be, the UFO tweet alert. People
UFO
tweet us
alert.
When they see UFOs.
I'm sure that already exists.
But, you know, related to the Santa Monica story, that's what happened with that one with Manu.
Absolutely.
The basketball player was tweeting about his UFO sighting, and that's
he
how
was,
it got all
he
over.
He was posting on Facebook.
Yeah.
Seeking information, asking people, you know, what they knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, going back to Jeremy with the Santa Monica thing, he pointed out that Twitter was just exploding when those incidents happened with people with the term Santa Monica fireball. So there were just hundreds of people posting about the Santa Monica fireball.
Just tweeting their heads off.
It's a great tool, though, and it spreads the word fast to people, and especially people who are connected to them or following them who may be in the same area. That's really cool because people can, at that moment, know there's a UFO and go out and see it for themselves.
Yeah.
So hopefully this encourages more people to be able to catch a UFO when it's in the sky and then maybe grab a picture or some video.
I'll have to remember to tweet. I have to add that to my list of my protocol when I see a UFO to tweet it.
You have too much on your plate already.
Yeah, I know.
On to WikiLeaks. For weeks now, people all over the world have been eagerly awaiting the secret UFO information WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange alluded to in an interview earlier this month. As would be expected, lots of rumors and speculation have been swirling regarding WikiLeaks and cables containing information relating to UFOs. But an interesting claim was made in an article in the European Union Times last week. The article claimed that a Russian report was circulating, which revealed the contents of an upcoming WikiLeaks release of secret UFO cables. These cables allegedly described a war against UFOs. The U.S. military had supposedly been in a war against fleets of UFOs emerging from the ocean near Antarctica. However, the British newspaper The Guardian says the WikiLeaks cables contain no references to UFOs. According to a recent article in The Guardian, despite what Julian Assange said in the online Q&A, there are no references to aliens in the cables. We searched for aliens and UFOs without finding any.
Yeah, you know, I was surprised that European Union paper had... I was surprised when I ran across the Russian story that you're talking about. But then when you follow the sources, the source was this really weird website that kind of talks about Nostradamus and I think them even talking to Nostradamus and stuff like that. So it was kind of a weird source. So that's when I kind of thought, oh, well, maybe this isn't the what's really going on. And then we saw this thing from The Guardian, and it is, you know, at first you would think, well, do they have all the files? But they do. They turned out that they were one of the five newspapers that were given all 250-plus cables in August, quite some time ago. And, of course, because it's such a big story, they held on to it, and they strategized around the releases with Assange and with other newspapers. In fact, they even gave the cables to the New York Times, right, who has all of them now. And so they do have them all. And to prove it, you know, they have a listing of all of them. They don't have the text inside. They don't give us, the public, that because they're holding that back for security reasons. They're not going to release everything. But at least they have all of the numbers and the dates and the who's and the where's to show you that they do have all this 251,000. And they did searches, and they didn't find UFO. And, you know, we wrote earlier about something about McKinnon being in there in those cables. But in the cables about McKinnon, they also did not mention UFO. They just said a hacker who is going to be extradited. And it was in a note to Hillary Clinton letting her know that, you know, they may bring up to you Gary McKinnon and the extradition. And that was the only remotely close reference to UFOs.
Right. And who knows? I mean, like, yeah, we said, it's possible that something could come out in future releases.
Yeah.
That some, in light way, mentions UFOs. But as we point out week after week after week, I think this is possibly another example that we see a lot of lately of people jumping to conclusions, wanting to find something or wanting to hear something about information be releasing. But as you pointed out, and as we've discussed several weeks now, I think a lot of people jumped the gun here and didn't pay attention to what Assange actually said. He was sort of poking fun at UFOs, saying, oh yeah, I always get a lot of weirdos contacting me about UFOs.
Right, and that was outside of the cables even. So,
right.
So he was kind of making fun of the whole thing in his full comment, which, except for the original interview with The Guardian, none of these other news sources, they kind of took it out of context.
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah.
Scientists think the sun could be the best communication device for contacting intelligent extraterrestrial life. A new study suggests the sun's gravity could be used to create a giant telescope that would magnify signals, both incoming and outgoing. The study also suggests that stronger signals could be achieved by using relay spacecraft to create a network connected by radio bridges. Claudio Macone, technical director of the Paris-based International Academy of Astronautics and the author of this new study on the mechanics of the proposed technique, explained, "If we use the sun as a gravitational lens, then we can keep in touch with our own probes, even at a considerable interstellar distances." The study appeared in a recent issue of the journal Acta Astronautica. Well, Alejandro, this could help SETI, possibly, and other organizations who are listening for signals in space, because using the sun and its gravitational pull could amplify those signals, and maybe we could finally hear something.
Well, what it just reminds me of, too, is this is kind of how they come up with new theories of communication or new ideas about how communication could happen, interstellar communication, and, you know, how SETI is kind of using these set rules that could be outdated even in our standards in 20 years, you know, 50 years. So those poor guys, I really think they're kind of, they ought to join our team.
It's got to be frustrating, I think.
Yeah.
Sort of defeating, but one day they'll find something. CNN reported last week about a UFO being shot out of the sky on Thursday by the Israeli Air Force. Fighter jets were scrambled when the UFO appeared in a designated no-fly zone above the Dimona nuclear plant, and the object was shot down. According to the CNN report, the Israel Defense Forces said the UFO could have simply been a party balloon, but having found no debris, they aren't sure.
Yeah, this is a
weird.
What's that?
Isn't that pretty weird?
That's a wild story. I know that they shot down an unidentified object. They think it could be a balloon. But then there are also stories in the Israeli news, I guess, that there were mentioned that it was a manned balloon, or not a manned balloon,
motorized.
But a motorized balloon. But, you know, what the heck would a motorized balloon be doing flying over there?
And why would they go through the trouble of scrambling fighter jets to shoot down a balloon?
Yeah, and the CNN story, well, because it could be surveillance or something, but the CNN story still said that they didn't know what it was because they claimed that there was no debris found.
Yep, no debris found. And I think there have to be more, probably easier ways to get a balloon down than fighter jets and missiles. But that reaction is also interesting. Because in the CNN article, they also say that last October, fighter planes were scrambled to intercept an ultralight aircraft that accidentally flew into the no-fly zone.
Yeah.
There. And they simply forced it to land at an airstrip.
They didn't blow them out of the
sky.
They
didn't blow it out of the sky.
Yeah.
And also, I don't know, it seems like they would know if a balloon's in the sky, but they don't really know what it is, and they can't find it.
Yeah, it seems like a really strange story, and this is, yeah, the area where they, it's still, it's kind of a, like Area 51, it's one of those secrets, quote-unquote, where everybody knows this is where they develop nuclear weapons, although they don't officially say that, you know, media and everybody knows that. So it is a highly secured area. But yeah, very interesting, weird story.
It is interesting, and it'll be cool if we actually hear more about it, but I doubt we will.
No.
Did you catch the meteor shower last week?
I did. See, you know, luckily I live out in the desert, and even on my ride home, I drive across, you know, a reservation where it's real dark by the Estrella Mountains, real pretty. And so even on my way home, you know, I'm watching those, got home and watched them for a little while. So some pretty cool stuff. But luckily I've got to see quite a few really neat fireballs on my way home, because it's so dark out where I am in the desert. So, but that was cool. You know, the meteor showers are always a lot of fun and capture people's imagination.
There's another aerial show tonight. Be sure to check out the lunar eclipse. People in North America will have a great view of the total lunar eclipse of a full moon in their winter solstice. The moon will pass through the shadow of the Earth early tomorrow morning for those on the East Coast, and shortly after midnight for those of us closer to the West Coast. This should be a particularly cool eclipse, as the moon will be turning a deep reddish brown.
Ooh.
This eclipse will last for more than 3 hours, and thanks to the winter solstice, the moon will appear at the highest peak in the sky, which should make for great viewing. This will be the first and only total lunar eclipse of 2010, in the view of next year's lunar eclipse, will not be as good for those of us in North America. And for those of you who don't want to stay up late to catch the lunar eclipse, NASA will actually be streaming the eclipse live on their website.
Well, even better, hopefully, because I got that, you know, my new cool camera, I'll be able to get some HD video of it with my telescope tonight.
I hope you do. That would actually be great video.
I'm going to try to do that. I'm really excited about it. We'll see what happens.
And just to clarify, Alejandro, last week's show is actually posted now on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/openmindsTV. I got it up today.
Well done, buddy.
Thank you. That is it for the news. Remember to check out these stories and more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm your Open Minds news correspondent, Jason McClellan, and you've been briefed.
I want to ask you something,
sir.
Before you go away.
You can ask me something.
Did you discover anything about 2012 in between margaritas while you're visiting the Mayan pyramids?
Only what I've discovered at every single Mayan ruin I've been to, and that is the dumb tourists always like to ask the tour guides about 2012 and the end of the world. And the tour guides, most of the time, are actually Mayan people. And they get a great kick out of it. But they always reassure everybody that it's just their calendar starting over and the start of something new.
Cool. So don't worry, people. If you're going to stress about anything over this holiday weekend, don't let it be 2012.
I agree.
Your last-minute presents and stuff are stressful enough.
I relinquish command of the show to you, Alejandro.
All right. Thanks. All right. Thank you, Jason. A couple other interesting stories I want to talk about real quick before we get to our guest that we've posted. First of all, we did post a story about the Guardian and the UFO files and all of those details. So you can go to our website and check that out. Also, the Israeli plant we have up there as well. And then Antonio Cuneas wrote a story about Irene Granchi. And she's a Brazilian ufologist. And unfortunately, she passed away last week at the age of 97. And she was researching UFOs up until the last minute. But his story's great because he talks about some of his personal experiences with some of the Brazilian researchers and some of the very interesting cases that those Brazilian researchers have looked into. So it's a great story. So you guys want to go check that out to read more about, you know, the Brazilian research and everything like that. Also, we do have more information about the Silver Surfer UFO and the Red Bull flyers, including some of those videos that Jason had talked about up there. And this is kind of a silly story, at least in my view, that I wanted to talk about on that was just released by the BBC. And essentially, a BBC radio host had kind of hyped up this special that they did about Rendlesham Forest and that they had some new discoveries. Well, their new discovery, his personal perspective, and now Bentwaters, where the sightings had taken place or where the Air Force men were based out of, and the Rendlesham situation. And we've talked about it so much in the last few weeks. You guys are probably well-versed by now. But his theory is that it was an Apollo capsule or a dummy Apollo capsule that was dropped by a helicopter probably when these guys were goofing around. So it's a really kind of preposterous, another Bill Nye type of explanation for the Rendlesham Forest sightings. Kind of silly. We posted a couple of stories on the site about this, but on the news area, the BBC did a really good job because the BBC talked about a lot of the different theories for the Rendlesham Forest incident instead of just the Rendlesham, the Apollo capsule, whereas some of the other news sources just stuck to the Apollo capsule. So that's a really cool story that you guys got to check out on the website. Otherwise, we have a few different sighting stories also up there, such as some New Jersey photos. And I think I might have talked about this last week. Maybe not. And these are photos from New Jersey that were part of the 1952 UFO wave. There's a big UFO wave back then, and one of the most popular sets of photos was taken by George Stock, who was a gentleman who, a photographer, who along with some friends had a sighting of your typical disc-shaped object. And of course, as is the case with a lot of photos from back then, I mean, they're almost too good to believe. They're your typical disc-shaped objects, but some really great photos. And back then, you know, these are 35 millimeter, and these people didn't have Photoshop or anything like that. So there's some extraordinary pictures, some of the best pictures that came from this UFO wave, where a lot of people had seen UFOs. And like I said, this one had multiple witnesses, so really interesting stuff. Go check that out. And that is essentially one of the feature stories at the top of our webpage. So I wanted to tell you some about the stories that are on the webpage at openminds.tv before we get to our great guest, who we will now bring onto the show, Mr. Michael Schratt. Cue the music. Ba-da-ba, ba-da-ba. Hello there.
Hi, Alejandro.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. So it's been a year now that we've been working on this magazine project.
Been a year. Yes, it has.
It flew, didn't it?
It did fly.
It keeps us busy, that's for sure. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about real quick is one of the stories that we just talked about, and that was the fighter planes with the balloons. I mean, would an F-16, and I'd assume they use Sidewinders, would they be able to shoot a balloon out of the sky?
Well, I mean, you think about the stall speed on an F-16, something like maybe 120 knots or something. That would be the minimum speed that you would be flying by. I would think it'd be very hard to narrow in on a balloon, something so small compared to something that's traveling so fast. And it's debatable whether you could get a lock on a balloon with a Sidewinder. It's debatable. I find that story very odd.
Yeah, it is a very strange story. Shooting, let alone any type of balloon down. So I wanted to ask your professional opinion on that.
And even if you did shoot it down, that would definitely go with the wind. You would have some kind of debris. Someone would see something, but it just seems very difficult for an Israeli F-16 to be shooting down a small balloon off of a party. I find that hard to believe.
Right.
I really do.
Well, I guess to start off, you know, I got a lot of subjects I want to talk to you about. You've written a lot of stories for the magazine, some really cool investigations and things like that. But I do want to ask the question you asked me actually a little while ago, which is, maybe what was your favorite story to work on in the last year?
Perhaps the recent stories about Ben Rich, also about the North Sea Aurora sighting in 1989. But I guess by and large, it's got to be Project Aquarius. I spent more time on that project than anything I've done here. So in essence, to answer your question, yes, it would be Project Aquarius.
Okay. So and with regards to the Ben Rich and the Aurora, I guess that's always the case. I'm like that too, where kind of your favorite stories are the ones you're working on right now because you're so into them, and those are the ones you're working on.
Absolutely.
That'll be in our, those stories aren't going to come out till April.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? The stories we're working on now won't come out till then. So I'm excited about those stories too. Those are going to be great. But let's talk about Project Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe describe what Project Aquarius is and where we got this information you worked on.
Right. Well, primarily, this entire story comes from Dr. Dan Burrish. I would just state right up front that I didn't make up any of this information. It came directly from Dr. Dan Burrish. As some may be familiar, he has a degree, 1985-1986, from UNLV as a biological sciences and a psychology degree. In 1986, he was approached by members of the Spook Group to work on these different classified programs. He received his PhD from the State University of New York, Stony Brook, and from there, the story has just snowballed from there. 1994, he was commissioned by the United States Naval Intelligence Organization to work at Area S4. So that's a brief thumbnail of how this began.
Now, so that is a mouthful. I mean, that is those are some pretty hefty claims.
Sure.
I mean, that he was working on all of this stuff. Really, thus far, it's some of it's difficult to confirm.
It is. That's true.
A lot of it. Although, we've met him, and my impressions were he was very intelligent.
Right.
I was shocked in the type of detail
mm-hmm.
that he would go into things. Did you feel that way also?
Absolutely. And what I'd like to do for the program, if we have time, is kind of do a virtual walkthrough of the S4 facility. You know, we'll take it through the hangar bays. We'll talk about the clean sphere. We'll talk about the different devices that were a part of this program. Maybe we can cover some of the aircraft, classified aircraft programs that took place north of Area S4. And then if we still have time, we'll consider just a few things from Ben Rich.
Okay, yeah. I have some other questions. I guess let's get into some of the other things that I wanted to talk to you about. Then we'll get into the details of this. See, we kind of pitched it, so everybody's got to stay tuned to hear what all the S4 details you talked about. But real quick, I do want to ask a couple things. I want to ask about the Bell. If you can kind of describe this. This is a German technology.
Sure. Yeah, it's a very fascinating subject. I've been following it for a while. By far, the foremost premier researcher on the Bell is Joseph Farrell. He's definitely the leader in the world on this. All this boils down to what happened at the close of World War II. We're talking May 1945, right in that time frame, the end of May 1945. Something happened to someone called SS General Hans Kammler. Okay, now he kind of led a double life because in one sense he was a genius, okay, a very good designer, but on the other side he was responsible for the concentration camps at Treblinka, at Dachau, and responsible for the murder of thousands and thousands of people. So it's a double-edged sword here. We're talking about a very nasty individual. However, he was also part of a program which has been confirmed called Die Glocke or the Bell, and it received the highest security classification of the SS at the time, higher than anything else they were working on. And at the end of World War II, the Bell, the papers for the Bell, up to 60 scientists were murdered over the program, and a Junkers 6-engine long-range transport all disappeared, and so did Hans Kammler. So the question is, this is the $64 million question that historians really need to pin down. What happened to Hans Kammler? We just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
There are five different stories of what happened to Hans Kammler. This was believed to be about 12 feet high, about 10 feet in diameter, very similar looking to what we know about the Keksberg Acorn. Mm-hmm. They may be the same type device. This device is believed to use a cerium-525, a nuclear-tipped isotope. It could be used to convert into a space-time bubble. It could be used as the ultimate weapon, so you could see why the Nazis would be working on it. And to make a long story short, at the close of World War II, it disappeared off the face of the planet. We have no idea what happened to the Bell.
And this was a device that, at least at the time when they were working on it that we know of, was extremely dangerous to be around.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Within hours of the device being tested at an underground facility not too far from their Skoda works in Czechoslovakia, the plants turned to a rubbery black substance. It was very toxic to be around this device.
Skoda works. What is Skoda?
That was their equivalent of their advanced design type manufacturing facility. They were working on anti-gravity propulsion systems, very high intensity cannons, weapons, all the secret technology that was procured within the SS was being developed at the Skoda works.
Okay. Do you know what the word Skoda is?
I don't recall exactly what that means.
Okay.
No,
just
that
curious.
Is the terminology for it.
Cool, yeah. So that was a great story. That was one of the stories you wrote about
right.
in the magazine. Another one we'll get into is the Blue Room.
Right.
And Barry Goldwater.
Yeah. Barry Goldwater was a very serious ufologist. He'd been chasing this story his entire life, essentially. I'm not certain that he got much further than the rest of us, even though he may have had a higher security clearance. We do have a documented case from ASU, also different documents that came from Tucson indicating that not only was he interested, but he did, in point of fact, speak to his good friend General Curtis LeMay, who is head of Strategic Air Command, and ask them, quote, "General, I know that you guys have a room called the Blue Room out at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base there. Can I get in there?" he asked. And so Curtis LeMay turned around and said, "Barry, don't you ever ask me that question again, damn it, because I can't even get in there." That's the response he got. And this is the only time where the general was extremely mad at Barry Goldwater. So the point is that it's not that Barry Goldwater was denied access to the Blue Room. That's not the point. The point is that General LeMay confirmed there was such a place because he couldn't even get in there. I think that's the point that we have to consider.
And he was at Wright-Patterson, LeMay.
Sure, he was the father of the B-52.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just like we heard from Colonel Halt, and we've heard from, I think, even base commanders at Wright-Patterson, that there are, just because they're the base commander doesn't mean they have access
absolutely.
To everything going on
absolutely.
At the base.
Absolutely. You have to have a need to know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. And here's the point we have to consider, is the UFO question, the answer to the UFO question, has now come outside the government's parameter and is now a privatized proprietary program. It's not a classified program. It's a proprietary program. Because if we're to believe the stories of crash retrievals, it would be the government that came to the manufacturers, Northrop, Lockheed, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, Aerojet. These defense contractors would have kind of a part ownership in the technology. So you can see how it's no longer a government issue. It's a proprietary manufacturing issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the first time I had an interview with, I cannot remember her name right now, but she was a therapist, actually, that was on Oprah quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a popular radio show. And I had mentioned about how private companies were
absolutely.
Involved. And she said, well, how could that be? And I explained, like you had done, and that they would have more of a need to know, because actually the Air Force, the Army, the Navy would all have projects with, let's
sure.
say, a Lockheed Martin,
mm-hmm.
whereas the Army doesn't share with the Navy, or the Navy doesn't share what they're doing with the Air Force, but Lockheed Martin and those people involved, they would have that information.
Right. It's the defense contractors. Like, mm-hmm. if you try to send a FOIA request to the Air Force requesting some new secret aircraft that Lockheed has built, you're not going to get it because it's proprietary to Lockheed, and FOIAs don't cover that. FOIAs
right.
do not go under that jurisdiction. So.
Which is an interesting point, something you said earlier, is that you've been able to get some of the photos and documents you've gotten not from FOIA requests, but going directly to these
right.
Contractors.
Personally, I have a vendetta against the government for one quick reason, and we'll just go off on a tangent here. The A-12 Avenger II was a joint McDonnell Douglas General Dynamics program, and Dick Cheney canceled this program on January 7th, 1991, here at Aviation Week Space Technology, January 14th, 1991, reported. So you can back it up with the paperwork. The bottom line is they blew $5 billion on this program that was supposed to be this all-weather attack aircraft to replace the A-6 Intruder, and yet, Alejandro, we have nothing to show for it. We just blew $5 billion. So we should all be getting a refund check. All this talk about a stimulation package, we're not getting anything for these programs. This is a travesty.
Mm-hmm. And that's $5 billion, right?
$5 billion with a B, yes.
Which is funny because, you know, how many people are there in the United States? It's 350
well,
million, I think.
Divide it and let's all get a check. I mean, really.
I mean, that's a lot of
that's
dollars
a lot of money.
Per person.
Remember, this is only one of hundreds
yeah.
of these programs.
Yeah. So literally, I mean, hundreds of our dollars, thousands and I'm talking on a yearly basis, thousands of our dollars. Personal, my tax money is going towards this.
You know what? Tupac was right. This is a setup. This is a setup. They tax what you make. They tax what you spend. They got you coming and going. You can't win in this system. This is a setup. And yet they have the nerve to spend these billions of taxpayers' money on these programs and then scrap the program, and we don't get a refund? This is ridiculous.
Well, and, you know, it goes back to, I think, what people don't understand, and this is what frustrates me so much with this kind of brazen, out-of-control, personal, just, I feel, capitalistic type of environment we have. Because, for instance, you're mentioning the Blue Room. And the Blue Room, it's almost as if these facilities, these government facilities, are really the military is the custodian of these facilities that are really being used by and maybe even supervised by these private companies.
Sure, sure.
So it's all private companies, right. And we're like they're the stewards of their, you know, the janitors taking care of their material and everything.
Absolutely. You've got three different segments of black programs. You have a black program that is any program that has less than 5% congressional oversight. You have a deep black program, and then you have a third tier, which is called a USAP, an unacknowledged special access program. And when you're working in those programs, anything goes. You can screw up. You can botch a program. The wing might fall off. But yet when it's a black program, all that gets swept under the carpet, and no one knows any better. And that could have costed $1.2 billion, and we'll never know about it.
Well, what do you think is happening with all of this stuff? There's all these black projects like this.
Right.
And like you said, there's a lot of these cases.
Absolutely.
The Aurora or others where, you know, they went deep black in the 90s, and then you hear nothing about them. But obviously they've spent more money and more development has happened.
Well, all I would say is I can guarantee you that this has nothing to do with finding bin Laden. This has nothing to do with something like this. Is much bigger. This is a much bigger issue. Why in the world would the government be using these tunnel boring machines that have a 40-foot diameter blade to it, and they've been doing this for over 40 years? This has nothing to do with bin Laden. This is a much bigger issue. I think they know something, or they know something is coming. They're preparing for something. This is much bigger.
What about all of these craft that have been developed? What do you think is it?
Well, for one reason, they have to control the high ground, because the Air Force has already stated that when you control the high ground, you control the world. So anyone who is able to maintain air dominance over a battlefield will always win, always win. And that's the goal. And they'll do nothing. They'll stop at nothing to gain that advantage.
You know, and what you're talking about, one of the things, and we were talking about this, and this goes back to some of what will be going on later with bases underground and stuff. You know, I paid a lot of attention to Colorado and ufology and everything going on there. And Space Command's headquartered there, so researching a lot of Space Command. And they talk a lot about expeditionary forces into space, controlling the high ground like you're talking about, but as if it's something they're doing. And then in the news, but all in a black world kind of place, then in the news we hear about this X-37, and we hear about this unmanned Space Command craft when it's coming back. It's been up there for 7 months. We haven't heard anything about it. All of a sudden it's landing, and now we hear about it. So it shows that there's a whole program in place of these spacecraft that's already rolling without us knowing what's going on.
Well, it's a laughable joke, because there are defense contractor people up at Lockheed, up at Northrop Grumman, and they're looking at us at our local air show, because they have an open house at Edwards every year, and they're just laughing at us because, you know, they're thinking that the American public is proud to see where our tax dollars are going, and we're looking at the F-15s and the new F-22, and we've got the B-2 over there, and sometimes they bring in the B-1 bomber. And, you know, we're supposed to be impressed with this technology. That technology is so decrepit and Model T Ford type, it's really horrible. I mean, it is not representative of the true technology that we really have.
And, you know, to back up your statement is related to the story you're writing about Ben Rich right now.
Right.
And maybe you can explain who he is and a couple of things he said.
I'm so glad you led into that. Ben Rich, personally, I believe, is an unsung hero in all of this. He was the president of the Skunk Works between 1975 and 1991 after Kelly Johnson retired. Ben Rich passed away in 1995. But in 1992 and 1993, this is a historical fact, he gave a number of slide presentations around the country. One was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio. This is dated September 22, 1992. Now, if you doubt me on this, I would just recommend that any listeners would please go to the Education Department and get the videotape for yourself so you can it's available. He also,
that's really cool. You can download this talk and watch it.
You can request it from them.
Okay.
They will allow you to get a VHS tape of it.
I think somebody has it loaded. I may be wrong. I thought I heard someone had posted it.
Another one was at the UCLA Alumni Club engineering speech of 3/23/93. So I'm backing up my sources. We have two people who were there. Author Tom Keller was there personally, and so was Jan Harzan. He's Orange County MUFON director. So we have two people who were there personally in the flesh that can confirm that Ben Rich did make these statements. So I'll just switch gears here really, really quickly. Just before he passed away, he told Jim Goodall, who's another aviation researcher, this is at the hospital on January 5th, 1995, 1 week before he passed away. He said, Jim, quote, Jim, we have things out in the desert that are 50 years beyond what you could possibly comprehend. If you've seen it on Star Wars or Star Trek, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from the head of Lockheed Skunk Works. Now, I find that amazing.
Yeah, and that, in the desert, when he says in the desert, where do you think he was talking about?
There is only one place, Groom Lake.
Uh-huh.
Of course, Groom Lake. Now, here's something very interesting.
Also known as Area 51.
Absolutely, the remote test site in Nevada. Now, here's another quote from Ben Rich, and this is a very interesting quote. Relatively new, and please confer with Antonio with this because he did the translation. This was published in a 1993 issue of Olfney World Almanac. Okay, so that's the reference for this. This is a conversation, telephone conversation between Harry Lebelson, who has passed away, researcher, and John Andrews, who's also passed away. Mr. Andrews was the senior project design engineer, Testel's Model Corporation in San Diego. And this took place in 91. And here's what he said. This is John Andrews talking to Ben Rich, and here's Ben Rich's reply. Quote, if I had used that word, snowbird, I would be in jail. Okay? Now, ufologists will recall that Project Snowbird was an alleged government program to build man-made flying saucers using off-the-shelf components which mimic the form, function, and fit of extraterrestrial origin points, okay? And that's based off of Project Red Light, which is the project to use American test pilots to fly extraterrestrial vehicles. Here we have the head of Lockheed Skunk Works essentially confirming that Project Snowbird is a real program.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another bombshell comment.
Yeah, some amazing statements, and we had Keller on the show who was there, and he talked about some of these, and he just seemed to be, he talked about him, about Ben Rich kind of being a maverick.
Absolutely.
You know, doing his own thing, and how he really was not into the secrecy.
Absolutely. Ben was trying to get these programs out to the public. When the Air Force released a very degraded photograph of the F-117, this is November the 10th of 1988. Ben Rich wanted that program declassified prior to that so that the engineers who worked on the stealth program could get the credit they deserved. You know, he also stated, we did the F-104, the C-130, the U-2, the SR-71, and the F-117, and many other programs that I can't talk about. We are still working very hard. I just can't tell you what we're doing. So, again, the Skunk Works has been building incredible technology that, according to Ben Rich, is 50 years beyond what we could possibly even dream of.
I think the big concern that people should have around this is that you know, we have, it hasn't happened in a while, but we've got problems with the shuttle. I mean, they keep delaying the launch. They're testing leaks and all of this stuff. We have lost astronauts. And this archaic technology, when there is better technology, safer technology out there.
You know what? You're so right, because it is a travesty against the American taxpayer and the astronaut safety who fly that obsolete garbage truck. I mean, you've got this huge external tank. You've got liquid fuel inside. You've got the two solid rocket boosters. Then you've got, you know, hoses and clamps and connecting points and multiple single point failures. It's such an obsolete way to get to space. Liquid rockets are the thing of the past. The Nazis were using liquid rockets before, you know, bombing Europe, you know, in World War II. Why are we still using this obsolete technology? It's terrible. It's horrible.
Let alone the lives it could save on the battlefield with our soldiers with some of these technologies. So, I mean, I the disappointing part is really the priorities. These people's priorities are not our priorities.
No.
They're not our interests or the interests of the country or the nation. And I think that's evident with these technologies obviously existing but not being utilized to protect Americans or American interests or these astronauts.
We are about 100 years behind where we need to be. That's really a fact. We're about 100 years behind where we should be right now. There's no need for liquid rockets to get to space. Think about it. If you wanted to go to somewhere way out in deep space and you're traveling at the speed of light, it might take you 100 years to get there. I mean, that's just crazy. Mm-hmm. We don't have anything better. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's sad stuff. So let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
I know it looks like there's a couple people in the chat that do want to get more into S4 and the base there. But I do feel, you know, and I want to ask your opinion on this, I feel kind of incumbent to bring up some of George Knapp's
absolutely
work in, with the Dan Burris story. And, of course, he found, you know, that Dan was working different positions in Las Vegas
mm-hmm.
during the time where he says he received his PhD. And Dan says, well, he was being flown by Majestic 12. Out to New York to SUNY
mm-hmm.
to do his degree and then working during the day. And that's a difficult, discrepancy to look past.
I'm familiar with all the comments by him, and I respectfully, you know, I take them very seriously. You know, I really do. However, all I would say is he was not present. George Knapp was not present with Dan Burrish as these blueprints were being drawn up. That's all I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Because the level of detail in these blueprints, I mean, you might be able to fake a few things, okay? You could, you know, maybe some of the layouts were just, you know, they were just faked here and there. But when you start getting into the biological labs, and you start breaking down the cyclotron machines or something in here and the way the test tubes were held and the refrigerators and the way that you put your hands on the desks and there's a designated place for you to do that and the weighing scales. And this, to me personally, talks about someone who was there and is speaking from experience. That's the impression I got from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, George Knapp may be correct, okay, but he wasn't there personally when I was being corrected by Dr. Dan Burris to the nth degree. So that's all I would say about that.
Yeah.
To me, it sounds like he's speaking with someone who has experience from being there in reality. That's mm-hmm. the impression I got from it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair perspective to share. And then before we
yeah. –
but just I guess so listeners understand, it is highly controversial, but I also wanted to ask, recently, I think you were able to get a hold of Bob Lazar and
yes.
ask somewhat about this stuff. What kind of response did you get?
I did speak to Bob Lazar about a week ago for about 2 minutes. And Dan Burris told me that Bob Lazar, and this is a true story, Bob Lazar has made some not so complimentary statements in regards to Dan Burrish, okay? And what I found was interesting is Dr. Dan Burrish did not return fire for fire. So to me, that showed a level of dignity, honor, and respect that he would not return Bob's statements back at him. You know, he didn't return fire for fire. So essentially what Bob Lazar told me is I asked him if he had received some of the material that Open's Mind had sent him on this project. And he said that he wasn't sure, and if he did, he wouldn't have time to look at it. So that was a bit disappointing. And then I said, Bob, I'm familiar with your account of seeing the aft end of the Aurora, and can you tell me anything about it? Did you see a side view? Can you tell me any other details about it? And all he said was, and this was under 2 minutes long, he said that the bus that he was on at Area 51 had blocked out left and right side windows. The only way you could see is through the front forward windshield. And so somehow it was lined up with the aft end of this large Copper Canyon Aurora-type vehicle that might have been a Mach 10 aircraft. And he said it had two vertical tails on the backside, and that's all he would confirm. He couldn't say anything else about a side view. I asked for any other details. He said, nope, that's it. I could only see out the front windshield. And so that's all he told me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I was able to confirm. Now, I would love to have bounced the Project Aquarius stuff off him and see if he could confirm some of these details, but yet he's too busy, or he hasn't seen it, or he won't comment on it. We just don't know. So that's where it stands right now.
Okay. Well, let's get into the S4 facility. Let's explain, first of all, what S4 is, how it differs from Area 51.
Well, Area 51 is Air Force Flight Test Center Detachment 3, okay? It's actually under the jurisdiction of Edwards Air Force Base in California. Now, if you go about 12 miles south of Area 51, you'll come up to this place called Area S4, okay? And the way you get to S4 is very interesting. And we do have some confirmation from Bob on this. According to Dr. Dan Burrish, after you have taken your Janet flight, the 737-200 from McCarran, okay, you're flying on this unmarked white Janet flight from McCarran. It has a red stripe down the side of it on both sides. And he said some very curious things. On the way to Area 51, piped through the PA system is a very interesting tune from Neil Diamond. Do you know what that tune is, Alejandro?
You told me, but I forgot.
It's Coming to America.
Oh, that's
okay.
Right.
Now, why in the world would they be playing that on a Janet flight to Area 51? Well, if you think about it, the whole theme of Coming to America from Neil Diamond is that immigrants are coming to America to make a better life for themselves. That's what this whole thing is about. However, if you interpret the secret, encrypted, symbolic message that's taking place with this song, and you portray it to what's going on at Area S4. So when you talk about coming to America, they're talking about extraterrestrials coming to America, specifically S4. And I asked Dan Burrish about that. He said, yes, that's the correct interpretation. So there's some symbology going on here. Now, the other thing is, as soon as you're getting ready to land, on approach to landing at the test site, there's a call from ATC at Dreamland, and it's called Pyramid, Pyramid, Pyramid. That is believed to be the ATC clearance to land at Area 51. So those are the two points. Once you land there, according to Dan Burrish, you are taken to Area S4 via Air Force Blue Bus, which we have a picture here, and it's all on the website, PDF file. Everyone can see this for themselves. Or you're flown via Black Hawk helicopter. And then the other thing, which I thought was very strange, is the doctor said that in some instances you may be flown to Area S4 via Soviet Hind gunship attack helicopter, of all things. Can you believe that?
Yeah, that's pretty strange.
That's crazy. There might be two of those in the world in operation. So I reported it as Dan had said. So when you get to the site, there's an unmarked helicopter landing pad, and there's an interesting thing here. There are two parallel red and two parallel blue lines going to the entrance to the S4 facility. And you are told to stay within those blue lines. If you break the perimeter of the red lines, you will be dead. You will be shot on sight. And so, you know, gentlemen, you'll be shot if you go beyond those red lines. I thought it just shows you how strict security measures are at this facility.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense, because anybody strays.
So now we're walking into the facility. We've opened up the door. We're going inside the facility now. There is a badging system that takes place. I don't know if we'll have time to go through all that, but to make this very quickly here, when you're walking down the hallway to this S4 facility, on the left, you will immediately have an avionics lab. Just beyond that, there's a propulsion systems research lab. There is a restroom and a briefing room on the right side. As you're further going down the hallway, to the left are the hangar bays. There's 9 hangar bays, okay? The first craft in the first hangar bay was Bob Lazar's sport model, okay? That was a P-45 J-Rod craft. The second hangar bay, too, is believed to be an identical P-45 J-Rod craft or possibly an ARV, an alien reproduction vehicle. So those are the two things that you'll see walking down this hallway. Hangar number 3 was a P-24 Roswell craft. This is interesting. I think Donald Schmidt and Tom Curry should clue in on this. This is new information about Roswell. The Roswell craft was a P-24, and it looked like, believe it or not, and this is coming from Dan Burrish and Phil Schneider, both confirming this, that the exterior configuration of the F-22, however crazy this might sound, was patterned after the Roswell craft. Mm-hmm. This is coming directly from Dan Burrish, because if you take the F-22, a top view looking down, and you draw a spline curve, and Dan did this with me. He said, remember back in kindergarten when you played Connect the Dots? Well, if you draw a point on all the major points of the exterior sector around the F-22, you'll have the P-24 Roswell craft. Mm-hmm. It was covered by a tarp.
That designation P-24, where does that come from?
That means 24,000 years into our future. Okay. Ah. So when you talk about J-Rod, and this is something we need to discuss here, there's a big difference between an extraterrestrial and an alien. A lot of people think it's the same thing. It's not. An extraterrestrial shares our same human lineage or DNA makeup. An alien does not share our human lineage, so that's the difference. And the term J-Rod, in its simplest terms, the word J-Rod means 15, okay? It's because that he came from 15 light years from Earth. That was his star system. And the term J was the keyboard significance that you see on a J. It's the 10th letter in our alphabet. And the dash or the bar is indicative of the Mayan glyphs for the number 5. So you take 10 and 5, you get 15. That's where J-Rod came from.
I see. And J-Rod was an extraterrestrial future.
He was a P-45 extraterrestrial that came back in time via the 1953 crash at Kingman, Arizona, because they were suffering a genetic neuropathy defect in hopes that they could cure it in our time so that when we evolve 45,000 years into our future, we wouldn't have that defect. That's why he came here.
45,000
years. 45,000, yeah. So as we get older, we lose our hair, we lose our teeth, and we start shriveling up and we die. And that's exactly what the P-45 J-Rod looked like. He was somewhat shriveled up. He was hunched over. He had very little hair, if any. He had almost like no teeth at all. And it's just exactly what we're evolving into. And so that was why he came back, in hopes that we would cure this disease so that we'd have a brighter future. That was why they were here.
So there's a lot of space-time type of questions and everything.
This is a huge story.
But at least in order to move on with the facility,
right.
I think, unfortunately, I know you guys are probably dying with these same kind of questions, going to move on to some of the other craft.
Let's do that. Hangar 5, believe it or not. Well, Hangar 4 was a P-52 Orion craft. Hangar 5 was empty.
Orion meaning from some civilization?
From the Orion star system. Okay. Yeah, the Orion constellation. Hangar 5 was an empty hangar. Now, remember, there are tracks that these craft can be rolled out on. That's how they get them out of these hangar bays. the next hangar bay, which is 6, was a man-made version of what was in hangar number 3. So we're looking at something that looked like the F-22 without the vertical stabilizers. The next hangar bay, that's 7, was something unknown. All Dan said, it had a tarp over it. He doesn't know what it was. So we have to leave it as an ambiguous type craft. Hangar Bay 8, he said that if there was anything alien in the entire facility, it was what was in Hangar Bay 8. He called it a black isosceles triangle that had a liquid mercury shimmering texture to it, and he said that it looked like you could fall into it. Those were his words. Very unusual looking craft, and he said that if there's anything alien, it was in that Hangar Bay. Hangar Bay 9, Alejandro, was empty, just like Hangar Bay 5. So that's a breakdown of the hangar bays.
Now, are these the same bays that Bob Lazar said he had seen?
These are the same bays that Bob Lazar were working at. But remember, Bob Lazar never got anywhere beyond that, okay? Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, too, that there's a catwalk above these hangar bays that you can walk down the length of, which Dan Burrish did, and looking off to the side, you could see a few more details. As far as we know, Bob Lazar never got that vantage point. He never got beyond Bay 1. So what he was seeing here may have been different because Bob Lazar describes different craft. Mm-hmm. He was there 88, 89. Dan Burrish was there years later in 1994. So there, you can see how there's a different times we're talking about here.
Okay, and this is all like first layer. Now,
right.
At just like with these different bays, Bob Lazar only saw, if you believe his story, some people don't, the first bay and was only able to work in a certain area because he only had certain clearance.
Right.
And with things being so compartmentalized,
exactly.
You only have certain access. It seems like Burrish says he had access to everything.
Well, he certainly had more access than than Bob did because uh-huh. Dan Burrish describes there being 5 levels at Area S4. Now, Bob Lazar never said anything about there being other levels. And this breaks down to level 4-1, 4-2, 3, 4, and 5. Now, Bob Lazar never said anything about that. We know that there were multiple programs going on at this facility. We've got Project Aquarius. That is an umbrella term for mankind's interaction with extraterrestrials. That's just an umbrella term. Under that, you have Project Galileo. That's the project that Bob Lazar was working on, reverse engineering the propulsion systems of extraterrestrial vehicles. That was that. Project Sidekick is the weapon system associated with those vehicles, which Dan Burrish will not discuss because it deals with national security, so he won't talk about that. And then we have Project Looking Glass, which dealt with an artificially induced time distortion.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the essential programs that were going on at S4.
And meaning that the Looking Glass was the time machine project.
Essentially, yes. We can talk about that when we get down to 4-2. But just to finish up with 4-1, remember... there was another gentleman who also talked about Area S4. He was working on the simulators, okay? Do you recall who that was? He was working on the simulators at Area S4. He gave a number of lectures at the International Congress. Anyway, it slips my mind as well, but he was working on the simulator. Bill Uhouse.
Ah.
There is something called level 4-1B, okay? It is a subset of level 4-1. It's not really a second level. It's just a sub-level. And there's a dolly that these craft can be tilted on to confirm the propulsion systems. And there's diagnostic cables that go back to a computer system that records all this. So it's important to remember that there is a diagnostic 4-1B associated with level 1. Now, just to wrap up the first level, there's a cafeteria here. There is a files department here. There's something called the training update tapes. That's something we need to get to. If we can ever get into Area S4, it's the training update tapes that we need to get. Videotapes of how you interact with these extraterrestrials.
Okay.
It's incredible.
That would be interesting. I was going to say training update tapes. That sounds pretty...
Yeah.
You know,
it's called,
that sounds pretty boring compared to getting one of these UFO spacecrafts.
Yeah, they call them the King Tuts. T-U-T,
oh, wow.
Training Update Tape. Very interesting. That's where I want to go. I would really like to get into this facility, go through all the files, and be the curator of the photo vault here. That's what I want to do. Anyway, now, interesting that Dan Burrish said that when you're in the cafeteria, they designate the people who work on the specific program. So you've got Galileo, you've got Sidekick, you've got Project Aquarius, you've got Looking Glass, and they all sit in their designated area. Red is for Project Galileo. Black is for weapons research. Orange is for Project Looking Glass, and blue is for Project Aquarius. So again, we see this compartmentalization, segregation throughout the entire facility.
Can they just converse with the people at the other tables?
I just don't know. Okay. I just don't know. I would think that you can't carry on this big conversation with someone who's working on Sidekick if you're working on... No, I don't think it goes like that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's drop down to 4-2 called Alice's Floor, because not only are we no longer in Kansas anymore, we're talking about a whole different level of a dream world here. That's why they called it Alice's Floor. And Dan Burr specifically stated that if there's any piece of nostalgia, and I hope that anyone who's working at Area S4 and all the people who are working at the test site realize that the one piece of nostalgia that we would like a photograph of, or maybe you can donate the real one, is that there's a statue in the entrance of the level 4-2 facility called Alice's Floor. There's a statue of an Alice in Wonderland rabbit there, and he's dressed in a maroon-red overcoat with golden fringes, and he has these buttons on, and he's carrying a clock or a watch. And this is indicative that we're going into a dream world, because we're talking about the Looking Glass device. That's what the symbology here is.
Gotcha. Which makes sense with Looking Glass, which is also a reference to...
Correct. So,
Alice in Wonderland.
Now, what we're doing here in 4-2, 4-2 not only held the primary Looking Glass device, but there were two secondary devices, and Project Sidekick was also located here as well. Now, I asked Dan Burrish specific details about Project Sidekick, and he will not go down that road. So I didn't pursue it because it was clear he didn't want to talk about it. But in essence, when you have Project Looking Glass, you're talking about a device that has, it's a ring-shaped device. There's an argon gas cylinder in the middle of this device, believed to be attached to an armature that has three-axis motion, okay? And this whole thing is spun, and there's these electromagnetic field lines that are forming above this Looking Glass device. And if you can think back to going to a carnival, you have a cotton candy machine, and there's these wire spires that form the cotton candy. Can you, I don't know if you recall
yeah,
that, but
yeah.
that's the essence of what this thing is doing here. And when they pump this argon gas into the cylinder, what it does is it can set up a field where you can see the probability of future events, okay? And that's the Project Looking Glass device. Now, there's a problem here. I want to repeat this. There's a significant problem called the Doctrine of Convergent Timeline Paradox. Yes. It goes back to Back to the Future 2, okay? When you look into the future, you can look into the future. Okay, that's fine. But when you act upon anything in the future, if you look, see, touch, feel, or smell, or act upon anything that you see, when you activate one of these Looking Glass devices, you are no longer on timeline one. You are now on timeline two, because you've effectively changed your timeline. And that's what they realized. Mm-hmm. And it was getting very detrimental, because you're altering our timeline. They have dismantled, per Dan Burr's discussion, they have dismantled the Looking Glass devices because of the doctrine of convergent timeline paradox.
Mm-hmm. Which would mean they kind of, this is your point, like on a tree branch where lots of branches would branch off, because
Absolutely.
You're creating these
Absolutely.
Other timelines. And so they made a bunch of those and said, oops, and turned it off, essentially.
Right. Now, here's the big question. Where did they get this technology? How did they access this? Well, the government, according to Dan Burrish, the government figured out how to access naturally occurring stargates, okay, from the cuneiform cylinder seals that we have recovered, perhaps at the Baghdad Museum. That might be one reason why we raided the Baghdad Museum, because of these things. But obviously, they knew about it before then. So that's how we were able to access, amplify, and get this technology from the Sumerians. So very interesting.
Oh, so that wasn't back engineered from...
Well, there are naturally occurring stargates as well as artificially occurring. And one way they were able to access the naturally occurring stargates is from reverse engineering or mirror imaging these cuneiform Sumerian cylinder seals. When you roll these things on wet clay, you get a relief. Now, when you mirror image that relief, all these 3D imagery start popping out, and that's how they did it. It's amazing. It's just amazing. It's incredible. Now, let's keep moving. Level 4-3, in a nutshell, Level 4-3 houses the residential units for MJ-12 members. There's three units. Each one has four. Three times four is 12, so that's where we get that from. That's in essence.
So all 12 MJ...
If MJ-12 comes to Area S4 for monitoring J-Rod interaction, they will stay at level 4-3. That's gotcha. Where they're going to stay. So in essence, that's what we have there. There's a storage facility here. There's a boardroom. Darren Burrish talked about animal and monkey cages. It starts getting real black here, but that's in essence what's going on here. There's a bio defense related type things here. Level 4-4, very interesting. It is the Aquarius level. It is called BCL, Biocontainment Lab. There's different laboratories here. You've got your solution. You've got a shower here. You've got scrum down. You've got dusting. You've got work areas. You've got the badging system where you trade your badge for a blue-colored badge here. It's a very interesting badging process that takes place.
For security.
For security, absolutely. And again, when I went through this with Dan Burrish, the level of detail that he put into this, the entry points, the windows, how you do the badging, the vacuum systems, there's no way. I mean, I suppose it's possible, but it just doesn't seem possible that someone could just make all this up. I mean, and remember, when I went wrong, he let me know it for sure. I mean, there were some points in there where, and that's okay, I'll take one for the team, no problem. I was humiliated by the responses I was getting. But it's okay. It was my mistake. I corrected it. It's in the PDF file. We moved on. It's fine. So it's important to document the mistakes as well as the successes. Okay, so we've covered that. 4-5, this is one of my favorite floors. This is the floor that Dan had his interaction with the J-Rod. We're talking about, and this has been described so wrong for so many times, and between Marcy and Dan Burrish, they finally were able to get this documented properly. And then I finally drew this up, and then we had all this made up in 3D. In essence, level 4-5 is a large square room with a scissor lift below it. Okay, most people know what a scissor lift. When you go out to LAX or you go out to O'Hare, you'll see a truck come by, and it'll have all the meals on it, okay?
Right.
You know, like for rich people or something. Well, you've got this scissor lift device, and they're putting, you know, candies and coffee in it. You've got the scissor lift device, and that was what was on the lower level of this 4-5. So this scissor lift device lifts up something called the clean sphere. The clean sphere is approximately 52 feet in diameter. It's about 2 inches thick. It is a clear polyurethane transparent dome. It's a half of a circle. So take an orange and cut it in half, and you've got the clean sphere. There's a grid system below the clean sphere, which the J-Rod stands on. Okay, and so that's how what the layout of this is.
So he's kept inside of this
he's
dome.
He's kept inside this pressure-induced clean sphere that has a very interesting pressure system that he has to survive in. And it's an oppressive society. They made fun of the J-Rod there. They didn't give him any clothes. The lighting was impeccable in the 4-5 facility. Throughout level 4-1 and down, it was kind of like gymnasium lighting. But Dan Burr said that the lighting for 4-5 was nothing less than impeccable. Okay.
In order for his to keep him alive, or
in
for
order
surveillance?
In order for Dan Burrish to do the tissue samples, because he took over 200 tissue samples from the J-Rod that through the microbiological research that he was doing and those who were working with Project Aquarius, they were trying to find the cure for the neuropathy, and that's what the samples were for.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the pressure-induced needle system. That's an acronym for the PINS device. So that's in essence what they were doing there. And this clean sphere device was a key element in this entire facility.
Wow.
Definitely. And so, you know, there's a whole protocol that you follow to get into the clean sphere. He had to be immersed in a liquid that would kill any germs totally. You know, everything was completely clean. He was in a test suit, a total encapsulated suit. So everything was handled very carefully.
We're running low on time, so you probably have time for maybe one more major point if you have one on there.
Okay, sure. Again, we mentioned that this took place from the 1953 crash at Kingman, Arizona. And to just to kind of wrap things up, what happened to the J-Rod is in 2003, Dan Burrish was at Abydos, Egypt, which is a temple down the Nile River, and J-Rod was put in something called the buggy, okay? And by that time, Dan Burrish and the J-Rod, who is called Kayla, they developed a friendship, okay? Non-communication. It was all, you know, through telepathy. They developed a friendship, and J-Rod was very upset that he couldn't see his family back at his home. So being a gentleman with dignity and honor, and Dan Burrish took a serious risk, he pushed the buggy device into this Stargate, and he sent J-Rod home. And so he went home.
So he sent E.T. home?
He sent E.T. home. That's it. That's
all
it.
All right, great. And, you know, I want to tell people that you've heard Michael, if you saw him on the video, you saw him flipping through some papers, or if you are listening, you heard it, because he has put together these really wonderful illustrations, incredibly detailed, very professional, because he's a draftsman, so that's what Michael does, that you can download in this PDF that he's been referring to. Just go to our website. In the search, put Dan Burrish, and you can download this PDF for free.
Absolutely.
It's some great stuff, and very soon here, probably in the next few days, very soon we're going to have a DVD prepared where we paid to have somebody do some 3D illustrations and animations of all of this. It's really cool, the video.
It is cool. It is cool.
So, and then Michael walks through that, his interview. You even see portions of your interview, right?
Yeah, we take you through a virtual walkthrough of the entire facility. It's mm-hmm. unprecedented. It's never been done before.
Yeah, so that's really exciting. Well, cool. Thanks, Michael, for
Thank
being
you.
On the
Thank
show
you.
Again and going through all of this with you. He's done some incredible work in the last year, like we've talked about. And all of his work, you can find at openminds.tv and in on the web and in the magazine. And on this DVD that we're going to be selling on the website.
Yep, that's it.
You'll be able to see Michael talk at the UFO Congress, and you're going to be talking about just this subject.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. All the visual, and Dan Burrish will be there to field questions.
Right. So Dan Burrish will be there for some Q&A, and you can get a feel for this guy yourself. And we'll be selling the DVDs and magazines and everything at the Congress, and you'll be able to meet Michael there and ask any questions that you have. And you can email at contact@openminds.tv, and that will get you more at mike@openminds.tv if you have some more questions. Anyway, thank you very much
for
being on the show again. Next week we have nothing because we're going to be taking it off for Christmas. However, the week after that, January 3rd, we're going to have Travis Walton, you know, the most famous abduction situation. They made the movie Fire in the Sky about it. So we will talk to you in another 2 weeks. You guys have a wonderful Christmas. Talk to you in a couple weeks.